That means we only do 11 chapters all of next semester. Because we stop at 39.
Okay, we left off in chapter 8, verse 4. So he's brought by the Spirit in this vision to Jerusalem at this gate, and he looks, and there's this standing image which provoked God to jealousy. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the vision that I saw in the plain. In other words, that chariot throne that he had seen in the plain, the same glory of God was now seen in the temple. The tremendous thing about this is that it was saying that God was still there. In his temple, though it was filled with idols, he had not yet abandoned his people. Now, when he does, it falls. It doesn't stay very long once he leaves. But oh, the long suffering and the mercy of God. We who have, one and all, set up idols in our temple, our body, our lives, our minds, our homes. Yet God has not abandoned us. But he deals with us, sometimes on a rather urgent basis. And if he ever does abandon us, we will fall, just like Judah did. Verse 5. Then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up thine eyes now the way toward the north. So I lifted up mine eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry. He said furthermore unto me, Son of man, seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel committeth here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? But turn ye yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations. Now, we're not told exactly what he saw in reference to this image in this second glance, but probably what he saw was Jews prostrating themselves now in worship before this idol, showing tremendous deception that had come upon the people of God, who knew better than that. They knew that God was one. They knew how he was to be worshipped. They, first or second commandment said, don't have any, make any graven images. Maybe the second one there. They knew better than that. Well, a so-called Christian nation knows better than to be doing some of the ridiculous things that they're doing today. The people, the gurus that they worship, and the astrology, and the occult, and the false religions, and the charlatans and hucksters and messiahs, quote-unquote, that they follow. They should know better than that, but they do it anyway. All right, now let's read verses 7 through 12 to see this even worse abomination. And he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I had digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said unto me, go in, and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things, and abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel, and in the midst of them stood Jaazaniah the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. And he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, Yahweh seeth us not. Yahweh has forsaken the earth. So now he sees elders of the land of Israel engaged in animal worship, introduced in an atmosphere of secrecy. Probably that which was practiced in Egypt, where they were great ones for the worship of animals. Some of the other nations did as well, but you know how Israel had a penchant for getting various worship and rituals and religions from Egypt. So here we are, seeing the elders whose job it was to protect the congregation of Israel from idolatry, leading them right into it. Well, there's parallels today as well, with the leadership leading the church of God, or the civil government leading the people away from God rather than to Him, worshiping the creature more than the Creator. Now, today's beasts may not necessarily be creeping things and abominable beasts, and this word creeping things can include, you know, the many of the unclean animals that you see in Leviticus, the snakes and the reptiles and so forth. Animals that are not fit to eat, let alone worship. But today it could be many of the men that have been lifted up and portrayed on walls round about, as it were, and worshipped by men. The Hitlers and the gurus and the Maos and the Rothschilds and the various other ones that have been lifted up in such high esteem, the Gandhis, and held in a higher esteem than the Creator, really, in effect, in many cases. The scientists worshiping at the footstool of science, the Darwins, the philosophers, the Kants and the Barths and the Freuds and the Tillichs and so on. Or look in the realm of entertainment, quote unquote, and you'll see the Elvis Presleys and the various other ones that are held in such high esteem. The Beatles, of course, you remember John Lennon's famous statement, "We're more popular than Jesus Christ now." And even though he did some furious backpedaling on that statement when he was confronted by it, and really only he knows what he meant by it. Still, it wasn't a very reverential statement, no matter if put the best interpretation on the words that you want. Now he's fallen into the hands of a living God, hasn't he? It's a fearful thing to do that. Not very seriously if he knew the Lord when he went out. Now, he sees, and these are things that are done in secret. That's why he sees a hole, and he's to dig through the hole. And then he sees it through the hole in this wall. And then when he gets on the other side of the wall, he sees a door. Then he goes through the door, and then he sees them in this secret chamber, as it were. So it's things that are done in secret by men who have a public office and ministry. And interestingly enough, even one of them is named. And this was a real man who was named, Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan. Now, this Shaphan may be the same one who was a... one commentator called him Secretary of State under King Josiah, but suffice it to say that he was the one who read the book of the law to Josiah when it was discovered when they were cleaning up the temple in 622 B.C. And he was probably a man of God. Here we have 2 Kings 22, verses 8 through 11. Well, a man of God, but his son fell away, although another son of Shaphan named Ahikam was an influential supporter of the prophet Jeremiah in Judah, and therefore probably godly. So of his at least two sons, one turned out good, the other turned out bad. With Ahikam, you could put Jeremiah 26:24. Apostasy in his son, apostasy in the scribes, apostasy in the elders. We just see people falling away here. And so there will be the great falling away that we are going to be observing before the coming of the Lord. And they're worshiping these things. That's why they have the incense going up. But he says, you see what these men are doing in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his imagery. Now this phrase, chambers of his imagery, is rather obscure, and it's hard to tell exactly what he means. But I give three possibilities. First, I'll read it in the NAS. He said to me, "Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark, each man in the room of his carved images? For they say, 'The Lord does not see us, the Lord has forsaken the land.'" First of all, look at their theology. it's almost a God is dead theology, isn't it, that was popular a decade or two ago. God doesn't see us. He doesn't know what's going on. If he did, he wouldn't care. He's not involved in the... For all practical purposes, they're atheists, or at least deists. You know, that if there's a God, he is no longer involved in the affairs of men. Now, first possibility is that it refers to other chambers in the temple where these acts were carried out individually. And the temple, you know, was really a complex or a compound of a number of buildings, and with many, many, many chambers in them. You see a glimpse of it in the book of Jeremiah, too, where there's a number of chambers, some of them named after various men. And Jeremiah goes into one of these chambers and has a dialogue with certain men that are in there. So maybe these acts were carried out individually, you know, each one in the room of his carvings. Or, and maybe they sometimes came together, or they're just shown as being together in this vision. Number two, some say it refers to the in the imaginations of their own minds. You know, in the chambers of my mind, as one old song went. Third possibility is that it refers to being to rooms in their secret rooms in their private homes, and that they had carried the idolatry into their homes now, and that they were involved in this worship in secret in their homes. Yes.
Do you see any significance in the fact that it says that the idols were portrayed upon the wall round about, as comparing it to the cherubim which were portrayed round about on the walls and curtains of the Holy Spirit?
The significance would be that they were a substitute.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Syncretism is what we're looking at here. The merging of any two or more opposing philosophies of religion. And the Jews became great syncretists when they left God, because they didn't leave all the trappings of that religion that they had had for so many years. They carried it right over, just like people today have all the trappings of Christianity, but in reality they're pagans. They're out and out heathen, pagans, for all intents and purposes. Verse 13, he said also unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Now, he's brought... to another location, and he finds these women engaged in the worship of Tammuz. And in this particular form of worship, it involved, there was a mourning and lamentation aspect of it, as well as probably some licentious fertility rites. Now, this is the only place in the Bible that Tammuz is mentioned. And at this juncture, I'm going to digress from the verse-by-verse commentary to read some background and information about Tammuz that Don compiled when he taught the class. And I'm going to give you quite a bit of information, more than you could ever take down at the rate that I'm going to give it. So you can just sit and listen to it, because when I'm all done, I'm going to give you a handout that's got it all printed up for you. And I'm just going to kind of buzz through it quickly. And I'm not an expert on ancient heathen religions and Tammuz and so forth, so I may not be able to answer a lot of your questions if you have a lot of them. Besides which, a lot of this is so shrouded in mystery, you know, you're going back into the mists of antiquity, that we can't be really clear what came from what and what was connected to what and so forth. But I think the point, though, that it'll be very well taken in all of this, is that there's an awful lot of overlap in the worship of these various gods from one culture to another. They all go back to the same root, Tower of Babel, basically, and from there just to the devil. All roads lead to Rome. All pagan worship leads to the pit, you might say. This Tammuz, one commentator said it was an ancient Sumerian god, and here in this notes it's called a Babylonian, but ancient Sumer was the, you know, really the root for Babylon, so pretty much one and the same. But this was the counterpart to the Greek god Adonis, or Adonis. And essentially, this god was a counterfeit Christ. And therefore, he is seen as a type of the Antichrist, who is also a counterfeit Christ, Antichristos, who will sit in the holy place in the last day, just as this is seen in a holy place being worshipped. 1 Thessalonians 2, you referenced there. I won't have to read these because you're going to get them. But and it's very unlikely that the Jews would allow a man to walk into the holy place in the rebuilt temple in the end of time if they didn't think that he was God or the Messiah. And so he's going to be an antichrist. He's going to be a counterfeit Christ. Now, in popular mythology, Adonis, I don't know if it's Adonis or Adonis, okay, so I just flip-flop here, if it's long O or short O, is this handsome figure of a youth, a man, young man. He's a beautiful youth, and he was beloved of the goddess Venus. However, Venus's paramour, Mars, became jealous of her love for Adonis, and so he arranged for Adonis to be killed by a wild boar while they were hunting. And but Venus interceded with Zeus, of course, the head of the pantheon, who allowed her to spend a part of each succeeding year with Adonis, who has already been slain now, by having him resurrected each spring. What wonderful gods these people served, huh? No holiness, no immortality, they could be killed, so forth. It's like God said, let us create man in our image. Then man turned around and said, let us create gods in our image, after our likeness, fallen. Now, Tammuz then would have been the earlier form of Adonis. Of course, the Greeks are coming later with that worship. And some think, as I think I pointed out already, that this image of jealousy in chapter 8, verse 3, could have been Tammuz. Others think it was Semiramis, who was his mother, and Nimrod's wife, and a forerunner of Venus, holding Tammuz. Anyway, these women that are seen here in verse 14 weeping for Tammuz may have been doing so because of the jealousy of their husbands, just like Mars was jealous of Venus. And the reason that their husbands may have been jealous is because, and I already alluded to this, that this worship may have involved not only the mourning but licentious fertility rites. And so perhaps becoming religious prostitutes, quote-unquote, having intercourse with the priests and elders before the god Tammuz, and in thus doing provoking both God and their husbands to jealousy. That's an educated guess based upon the knowledge of their pagan spring rituals, although it doesn't say it here in the context. Besides, these women were seen in the court of the men, and therefore they were possibly usurping the place of man in this worship. Now, Tammuz became the god of spring vegetation, and he symbolically died in June when the earth's productive powers decayed, and went down to Hades, and then was resurrected each spring when the earth's, you know, potency was renewed. And the word for June in the Syriac language is Tammuz. And during this time, as I said, they had very licentious, immoral ceremonies, fertility rites, and so forth, which included women wearing the male organ. And I don't know if this is in the notes here, but I remember it right now, that I think it's the fourth month in the Israelite calendar, is the word Tammuz. So somehow that got into their vocabulary, and even as one of their months. Now, Tammuz came from Babylon. But a number of other nations had the same worship. Phoenicia and Greece, where, of course, he became Adonis. And some feel that that was a perversion of the Hebrew word Adonai. Adonai or Adonai, the word for Lord. Anyway, Satan was using Tammuz as a deceiver of the world. And he had a greater understanding of the plan of God than a lot of people give him credit for. You know, as being just dumb and just going about, you know, like a rowdy, trying to make as much trouble as he could without really having an understanding of what God was trying to do and therefore trying to duplicate it. And Satan had to be able to somehow understand prophecy from the Bible or know something from God himself from the position that he had held in order to be able to anticipate the coming of Christ, because this is way before the time of Christ we're looking at, all the way back in Babylon or ancient Sumer. And he's been able to foist counterfeit Christs on the world down through history so that when the real Christ came, men wouldn't recognize him. Oh, another one of those. You know, we've had those before. And so he became only one of many saviors. And as a result, men, and many have been deceived about who Jesus is. and liberal thinkers have been able to ascribe conservative Christianity to an evolutionary process which grew out of these pagan systems. See, monotheism grew out of polytheism. Christianity kind of grew out of Judaism and a mixture of other, you know, a mixture of pagan religions. Anyway, according to some sources here, Tammuz was born of one that was supposedly a virgin mother, Queen Semiramis, and Tammuz was her beautiful, powerful child. And but in this case, Tammuz's mother married Tammuz. She married her own son. Again, kind of a counterfeit in the sense that Mary will be part of the bride of Christ, you know, in the spirit, spiritually speaking. Now, the and I got it mixed up when I was talking about Nimrod before. It's the other way around. The son of this relationship was known as Bacchus, which means the lamented one, and was known as a wine bibber, became part of the Greek pantheon. But the son was also called Ninus, which means the son, and he became King Ninus, just as Jesus will become King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And this Ninus was otherwise known as Nimrod. And his mother was called the Goddess Mother, and mother and son were worshipped together, just like you see that today in the Roman Catholic Church, which considers itself the Mother Church. So Tammuz then became both son and husband to Semiramis, and that led to confusion, which is nothing new in heathen religions. But and in the Egyptian religions, Osiris and Isis were often mistaken one for another because they were both called the same god at times. One was a greater god, one was a lesser god, and yet they were both the same, and that was a great mystery. And there you're looking at Logos, Christology. So the same thing that happened to Tammuz also happened to Osiris, Adonis, and all the subsequent gods, because they're all actually the same god. Osiris died, he was lamented, then transported into the afterworld, just like Tammuz and Adonis, and just like Jesus. And in India, the same characters in Satan's mask are called Iswara and Issi or Parvati, his mother. Now, when alive, Tammuz was a hero. When he died, he became a god. He was deified. Even as Christ was, as it were, a hero in this life and died and was now seen as deified or as God. But again, what we have here in these gods of men are not gods that are gods by nature, you know, Theoi, but they're heroes who were deified. So they're really demonii. They're really demons. Now, Tammuz's mother, Semiramis, became Aphrodite in the Greek pantheon and Venus in the Roman. Aphrodite was, in popular mythology, the perfection of womanhood. And she was thought of as being the hope of the world, quite a bit like Mary, who became the Alma Mater, which means the virgin fostering mother. And that term, of course, is used for the college that one graduates from. It's your alma mater, the mother that bore the person, in a manner of speaking. Aphrodite's symbol was the dove with the olive branch in its mouth. So here again, the dove, symbol of the Holy Spirit, olive branch, Genesis chapter 9, symbol of peace and the ending of judgment. Semiramis and Aphrodite were both unfaithful and bore sons, so there's parallels there. Semiramis became the goddess of love and sex, and she bore a son named Eros, Eros, E-R-O-S, and that's the root for the word erotic. And Eros is now known as Cupid. And Nimrod of Babylon is the same god symbol as Cupid. He was the son of a virgin goddess who was unfaithful to her husband, and although she claimed that her son came from God. Alexander the Great had a similar background. His mother said that Alexander was not the product of herself and Philip, but of a god, and that made him a demigod. Alexander therefore thought himself apparently to be a god, and apparently people worshipped him as God. He was deified. So Semiramis brought forth Nimrod by a god through a virgin birth, and therefore Nimrod was considered a god. Do you see how that was anticipating what God would do? Of course, Nimrod built the Tower at Babel. He built very many many other cities, the beginning of Babylon and Assyria, most likely. And so the first attempt at world government came during his lifetime and under his hand. One of Satan's first attempts, if not the first attempt, to control all men through the use of religion by deifying the man, hero when he's alive, God when he's dead. So there's very strong parallels to the Roman Catholic Church's methods of controlling kings and countries during the Middle Ages, particularly by means of the papal interdict. Now, there are many references both in the Old Testament and in history that connect a whole host of gods and goddesses with Nimrod and with his mother. There are familiar rhymes and verses, signs, sayings, songs, and religious practices that can be traced back to Nimrod. Pope Gregory the Great brought in songs identical with the tunes that were used in Persian worship of these false gods, for example. Most all gods, when traced back far enough, can be found to be connected directly to the legend of Nimrod and his mother. They are counterparts and, of course, pointing toward the Antichrist. Here's some other examples, evolution of some of these other gods. There's the god Bel, sometimes called Belus or Cush. He was supposedly the founder of Babel, and he was a god of Babylon. The goddess was Beltis, his counterpart, and there's a speech by Nebuchadnezzar that extols Beltis. But Belus became Baal, and Beltis, the goddess, became Baalti or Beltai. Now, the Latin word for Beltis, the goddess, is Mia Domina, and later it became conflated to Madonna in the Italian, or the English, My Lady. Cush's son, Nimrod, was Belus, and his mother was Semiramis. Semiramis became Nimrod's bride. Cush, his father, became angry and slew Nimrod. Nimrod was mourned and deified. Now, Cush begat Nimrod, and see if I have this right now. Yes, and Ham begat Cush. And Ham, of course, was cursed, as we see in Genesis chapter, 9, I think. So Cush is closely tied in with Nimrod's accomplishments of city building. So there's a relationship there with the Hamitic curse. Now, Adon, the word for Lord, became Athon, or Athan, and Athena is the feminine form from which came Athena, who was the mother of Corybantes by Helios, her son. So here's another goddess, where it came from, tracing it back to there. Ham, or Hem in ancient Babylonian language, became Her, H-E-R, and this name evolved into Hermes. So here's Ham being worshipped in his own land. Again, Ham begat Cush, who begat Nimrod, who founded Babel. Ham, meaning black or burnt one, was identified with the sun and was worshipped as the sun god. And Baal also became a sun god. In Egypt, Ra was the sun god, and Ra became Ramses, or Pharaoh, or Cush. Osiris apparently also means black, and he was seen as a Negro clothed in a spotted garment of leopard skins, kind of a parallel to Nimrod in his life history and appearance. In China, Buddha is sometimes seen as a Negro. So here's some Hamitic tie-ins with Ham. Black magic was seen as coming from the black god. In Egypt, the initials MS means to bring forth, or refers to a woman bringing forth. And it was derived from a goddess, Mes, M-E-S. And they combined Her, you probably know where I'm headed, Her, and remember, Her was Ham, we got to keep all these straight, and M-S, or the god Mes, and they got Hermes. So Hermes, one of the Greek gods. So Ham plus M-S means to bring forth a child. And so here today, liberated women are taking the M.S. name, Ms., not Mrs. or Miss, which goes back, whether they know it or not, to ancient Greece and Babylon. So a Ms. woman is a woman, married or not, virgin or not. So like Semiramis, she can conceive, have intercourse as she pleases, and is above the laws of God. She's a goddess in her own sight and has to answer to no one. She can conceive and bring forth a son. And here's one of Don's predictions, that the next liberated women are going to begin to take their sons as their lovers and husbands, and it will become a common practice, and that the standards against incest and intermarriage will have to be changed or adapted as a result, and the sons will be submissive to their mothers and will better serve as lovers than the husbands would. Could very well happen. Oedipus complex. Page 4, last page on this handout. Another prediction, it's the same prediction continued, that the liberated woman pays great attention to the ownership of her own body, claiming that she's not owned by her husband, which is in typology saying Christ doesn't own the church. And yet the Bible says you're not your own, you're bought with a price. So she's being led as a result into lesbianism by being brainwashed that her husband does not understand her as a female lover can. Then the next point is that nearly all gods and goddesses of the religions of the world, as well as their rites and their symbols, are modifications or evolutions or derivations of Ham, Cush, Nimrod, and Queen Semiramis, these few people. This includes the American Indian buffalo dance with its horns and their symbolism, Saturday coming from Saturn, which is related to Satyrs, the man horse with a bow, Atlas, Zero became Zorro, and this was derived not Zorro from the Western, but who knows? We'll throw him in for good measure, too. But throw him anywhere. Just get him out of here. But it's funny, but it's really pathetic when you think about it, how the whole thing is a mess. I don't know if you've ever looked at, if you've ever played with word etymology at all. I was looking up a word the other day. I knew the meaning of the word, but I wanted to look it up again just to refresh my memory. It's a word that means speaking in a loud voice, and the word is stentorian. So I looked up the word just to get a, you know, look at it again. And then I look at, and then I look in the etymology part of it, you know, in parentheses at the end of the definition where they tell you where it came from, and it says it came from stentor, the Greek god of messenger god who was said to have a loud voice. And I thought, oh brother. It's almost like you can't use a word, you can't refer to anything in life that somehow hasn't been tainted and touched by pagan idolatry, and then you start, and then you jump onto the chain and you run it back to its source, and it all started back there. That's where the devil had them all under one head, and he could get them all in this worship, and then it spread from there. It's just ridiculous when you think about it. Does somebody have a question, or Greg?
The Bacchus degree.
Are you telling me now that bachelor comes from Bacchus?
I've read a little bit. I'm not sure. I looked it up in the dictionary, and it didn't take it back far enough. But
what does it do with the word theology? You know, theos and logos. You take theos back, and it's a pagan Greek word, you know, referring to the gods and their pantheon, until the Holy Ghost takes it and applies it to God. I mean, anywhere you want to look. So it's almost like the devil took that which belonged to God, and he perverted it, and he says, it's mine. And now God's people are taking it back and says, no, it's ours. You know, we have a right to those words and symbols and things and so forth, and because they can be applied to God. They can point to God. They have their rightful use, you know. I think a supreme example of that is the dance. You know, I mean, the devil has owned that one long enough. And now God's people are taking it back and saying, hey, we have a right to express ourselves bodily in this temple that God has given us and that he's dwelling in. Why can't we express exuberance and joy in worship of God who made us? If they can worship themselves or whatever they're doing out there. And so we're just like taking back. It's restoring the days of restoration like the Bible talks about. The things that were man's in the beginning but that the devil took from him. So really the devil doesn't own it. God owns it. But the devil borrowed it, swiped it, and now we're taking it back for God. Anyway, just to finish out here. some of these other things that are derived one way or another from these four personages would include nuns, the phrase by Zeus, meaning by the Savior, amulets, especially erotic things, and the gods Astarte, Baal, and Cupid. Then he says this is infiltrated in so many areas that the world is unaware of their sources, which is true. When scholars begin to dig, however, these connections come out. And so it's like Satan has planted a diabolical trail throughout history. And then a point on the evolution of the myth surrounding Mary. Mary, Jesus' mother, was Jewish, of course. She probably had dark hair and dark eyes. Ancient pictures, before Raphael, departed from tradition. ancient pictures before Raphael departed from tradition showed her as a blue-eyed blonde. And all of the following were also blue-eyed and blonde. Europa, a Roman goddess. Minerva, goddess of wisdom. Diana, goddess of the hunt, Jupiter's daughter. Dione, mother of Venus, and Venus herself. Lakshmi, the Indian goddess, mother of the universe. Of course, Mary is called Queen of Heaven. Ariadne, mother of Bacchus or Nimrod. Atar goddess, the fish goddess of Syria. She was the mother of Semiramis. We get mermaids from this. Athor, the Egyptian cow goddess, or Hathor, sometimes called. She's the Venus of the Egyptian pantheon. She had a golden head and neck and was manifested as a woman also. That's some evolutions of the myths concerning the sun. Christ's halo is thought to have come from the disk of the sun divinity, Sol. You know, the halo that they put on him in the pictures. Sunday, of course, is the god, sun god's day. Constantine felt that there could not be a better day to worship the sun of righteousness than the day of the sun god. So they merged the two and it became acceptable to the pagans that way. And then, going back to where we left off, up in verse 3, when he talked about an image of jealousy, in his book, Two Babylons, Hyslop thinks that this directly points to mother and child worship. So he feels, again, going back to this, that it was not just a mother image or the son image, but it was the worship of both. It's a possibility. Okay. If somebody wants to pass these out, I'll go ahead and give you these, and you can just keep these with your notes. That's everything I read. I read it right from here, which is actually more complete than Don's notes. I've got a copy of his notes on section 2, but of course he elaborated as he talked, and a student took it down, and then we had it typed up. So this is more complete than I have in the lecture notes here. So maybe if somebody could pass those out. Thanks. For those listening on tape, this is file number 1, and it's a partially blank sheet on the front that says note, and then on page 1, underneath that, it says background and information about Tammuz. Ezekiel file number 1. I need to put some of those in the library for the tape students, too. Maybe somebody could remind me of that after class is over. I'll probably forget if you don't.
I'll be going to the library after the next class so I can take some.
Could you? I appreciate that. They would go, you know where the file cabinet is there? And then just under Ezekiel? You could take all these copies. Hopefully there will be enough. Thanks. Did everybody get the roll book? Okay. Now see, all of that information may not necessarily be accurate. Like I say, when you go back that far in time and you start digging and trying to find connections to this, that, and the other, we don't necessarily have all the whole story. We may have just a little tiny picture of it. But it's just interesting to see how these things have evolved over the years and spread into the various cultures, and then tragic to see how the Jews fell prey to this very same thing. All right. Verse 15. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the... Okay, we already read this, didn't we, worshiping the east? Did we read through verse 16?
No.
No, we didn't. Okay. At the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. And he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence, to have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. So now he turns again and he sees something even worse. It's almost like the more revelation a person gets, the more he sees of the works of the devil around him. You know, the more infiltration of demonic practices and paganism everywhere you look, almost. Now notice that these men are standing between the porch and the altar. Now that means they're in the inner court, or the court of the priests, which means they were priests, most likely, because only priests could go into that area. So instead of doing what they do in the book of Joel, weeping between the porch and the altar for God's people and crying out for mercy, as we see in Joel 2:17, instead, they have their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and you know what that signifies. Contempt, disdain, rejection, denial, scorn. And their faces toward the east because they're worshiping the rising sun. And he calls it a greater abomination. Because now, you see, because, and why is it a greater one? Well, perhaps because the others still included the Lord, at least ostensibly, in the temple. So we worship Yahweh and we worship these two, but now their backs are toward the temple of the Lord. Total rejection of Yahweh. So it's not an adding to the worship of Yahweh, it's subtracting the worship of Yahweh and worshiping this image of the sun god, the sun deified as this god only. Willful sin, continuing in it, results in a loss of light and darkness that is going to come upon them. Now, we're not told who these 25 are, but they possibly could represent the 24 courses of the priests of Israel, and then the 25th one being the high priest. At least during the time of David, some 400 years earlier, he did divide the priests into some 24 groups or courses by which they ministered. And maybe one man representing each of those 24 courses, plus the high priest, with this 1 Chronicles 27, verses 1 to 18. And of course, again, this would be greater abomination because of who's doing it, isn't it? The priests with greater light, the ministers of God. Rejecting the temple of God represents rejecting the standard of truth, the standard of judgment, the light of God. And worshiping the sun, and remember the temple was oriented toward the sun, toward the east anyway, so that made that very easy to do. And he says, look what they've done. Have you seen this? They've filled the land, and he talks about their other sins, violence and so forth. And he says, and lo, they put the branch to the nose. Now, we have absolutely no idea what that means. No idea at all. But I don't think it was to sneeze like I do in springtime. But and there's some conjectures. Some say it was the worship of Tammuz. It's ridiculous, isn't it, what the devil gets people doing? It's utterly ludicrous and pathetic. Some say it was a gesture of obscenity. Others say that it referred to some sacred twig when praying by the sun worshippers. So some magical ritual to drive demons away, supposedly. Probably brought them to them, huh? Homing device. Guaranteed to bring every demon in the neighborhood. Others say it was just a gesture of contempt toward God. In any case, it couldn't have been very good because the Lord mentions it and he says, look, they even do that. And therefore, he says he won't spare them. Chapter 9. Remember now, same vision. He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lies toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side. And they went in and stood by the brazen altar. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was, to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and cry for all of the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. Now, in chapter 8, verse 18, the previous verse, he said, though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. So they can cry out under the pressure and the despair and the anguish and the pain of their calamity, but he wouldn't hear them. But now, in contrast to Judah's cry in God's ear, God cries aloud. in his ear with a loud voice, showing what? The magnitude of the message, the importance of it. God did not want Ezekiel to not hear it or to not understand it. Something that's brought with much emotion. God is stirred in his wrath over these abominations. Now, and Ezekiel hears, and God wants those that have charge over the city to come near with destroying weapons. These are angels. You know, angels have authority over cities, over nations, over territories, over peoples, over religions, over various other affairs of men. So here we have angels of vengeance. Now, it's not necessarily clear whether it's, you know, fallen or unfallen, but the point is they're under God's direction in what they do. That's the point. They're doing God's bidding. The NES says, "Draw near, O executioners of the city." And remember that this is all in a vision, and basically what it's representing is that Babylon is going to come and destroy the city. So it's not so much to be taken literally that each man had a mark put on his forehead by an angel. But the point that God is making is, I want to know of all of those who really love me and who hate what they see going on around them. Because I'm going to spare them. You know, I'm going to protect them in that time. Verse 6 then, he sees six men come from the way of the higher gate. Now, again, these are angels, but they're seen in the form of men in a vision. Notice the number 6, though. 6 is the number of what? The number of man. That is telling us that God is going to use man to judge man. In other words, he would use Babylonian swords under Nebuchadnezzar to judge his wicked people. And they came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces the north. That's what that's saying. Came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces the north. Which means they came from perhaps one of the two places where there was false worship. They may have come from where that image of jealousy was, chapter 8, verse 3. Or they may have come from the place where the women were weeping for Tammuz, chapter 8, verse 14. Or maybe it's indicating from heaven, because remember, north in the Bible often just speaks of the direction from, you know, of heaven. And they came, each man, with a slaughter weapon. It's an indefinite term. And it's probably just as well then that the King James left it that way. It's not clear whether it's a sword or a mace or a battle club. But it's something that is, you know, a weapon, an instrument of destruction. Now, he sees these six men, and then he sees a man among them, clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side. Now, this makes a total of 7. There are the six men with the slaughter weapons, and there's the one who is among them, but not counted among them, but he's among them in linen. A total of 7, showing complete protection for those that sigh and cry, for the abominations, and complete judgment upon those who don't. So among them doesn't mean he was one of the six, because he's got the equipment of a scribe. He's got the little writing case, and because he's going to record. And therefore, most likely, 5-minute bell, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most likely, he is an angel who is superior to the six destroying angels. Names like Michael or Gabriel, for example, could come to mind. In any case, they come and they stand beside the brazen altar. And of course, that is where the offerings were made, day in and day out, for the sins of Israel. And so judgment is going to be pronounced at the very spot where sins should have been forgiven. But that altar had now been desecrated by their sin. And God would not remit sins. Even though sacrifices were brought to the altar, if this is what was going on in their lives and in their hearts, they had desecrated it. Like it says in Hebrews 10:26, to reject Christ, then there remaineth no more sacrifice for sin. Now remember that this is in a vision. No six men could destroy the whole city. Six angels could, but six angels aren't going to. the Babylonian army is going to. Although I'm not saying that God's angels weren't somehow involved in what went on. I mean, we know so little about what they do traveling in those realms that we are still such foreigners to. But they were watching over the city, watching over God's people, as we have in Daniel 4:13, the word watcher. Just like the destroying angel was sent to Egypt to slay the firstborn. If you look in Exodus chapter 12, where the regulations for the Passover are given and then the 10th plague occurs, sometimes it says, Yahweh says, I'll go through the land. Another time it says, I will not allow the plague to come upon you. Another time it says, I will not allow the destroying angel to judge you. And you put it all together, and apparently it's saying that the Lord allowed destroying, you know, angels, which either, again, fallen or unfallen, we don't know, but to go through and do that. But what they brought was a plague upon the people. It was a judgment. And but since God was directing him, it was him doing it, in essence. Destroying angels, of course, were sent to Sodom. Now, that may have been just one destroying angel, because he says he will not allow the destroying angel, although he may have been using what we call the, what's the word for it now in grammar? I don't remember the word for it right now, but it's where one stands for many, and the word for that. Because they're in Psalms, I think it's 78:56, if I remember right, in reference to the plagues, perhaps including the 10th plague, it says he sent evil angels among them. There we know it's fallen angels. Evil angels he sent among them. Two destroying angels, of course, sent to Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, Zoar, the cities of the plain. But notice six are sent to Jerusalem. Greater guilt, judgment upon them, upon the wrath of God. Now, seven destroying angels are seen in the book of Revelation, pouring out those seven vials of wrath. One destroying angel destroyed the army of Syria. If I remember right, it was called the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh. But again, remember, the Babylonians actually slaughtered them, but the six angels are shown to show that God allowed that. God allowed Babylon to do that. And again, coming from the higher gate that faced the north, in other words, coming from the north, just like the vision in the very beginning came out of the north that Ezekiel saw, chapter 1, verse 4. Just like the Babylonians, who, though they were due east, following the Fertile Crescent line, would come down from the north, Jeremiah 4, 6 through 7. Verse 3. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. So God moved from his throne place in the center of the true spiritual Israel of God to the door of the temple. And the same, just like he used to stand in, before the door of the tabernacle and addressing Moses and Israel in times of old. And what he could be saying here, and I close with this remark, is showing that he's leaving, but he hasn't fully left yet. There's just, although he will come back before he leaves totally, and see, he's seen last out on the hill east of Jerusalem, probably the Mount of Olives, but also showing that judgment is beginning at the house of God, and that that's where it starts, and that's where the recording angel is told to bring this judgment and put this mark. All right, and we're going to put a mark right here in our notes, and when we come back last week, we were here last week, I think. When we come back next week, we're going to be looking at this word for mark in verse 4. I think it's kind of an interesting word, because it happens to be the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And then we will continue with this chapter. You're kidding. Another break? Oh, okay. Well, 2 weeks then. Yeah, we just had one. They come close together in the spring semester, I guess. 25th and 26th then, is that what next week is? Monday and Tuesday, we're off. Okay. Don't come next week then. We'll see you the next week after that.